Job chapter 23, he's in the middle of answering Eliphaz, who has made his final accusation against Job, saying, "Job, if you'd seek him, if you would seek out his presence, he would bless you. Things would change. If you would get your heart right, his hand would be on your life again." And of course, that couldn't have been further from the truth. Job begins to answer in chapter 23 saying, "I wish I could find him. I wish I could speak with him. I wish I could meet with him, that I could issue my complaint, my arguments before him, and then that I could listen to what he would have to say. Would he use his almighty power to condemn me?" Job says no, but he would speak strength to me. "I have sought him facing east. He wasn't there. Facing west, couldn't find him. To the north, I saw his hand working, but I couldn't find him. To the south, he was hidden." Job saying, I'm seeking my bearings in the midst of all of this, trying to find my way. I see God's hand, but I have no personal sense of his presence. Verse 8, "Behold, I go forward, but he is not there, and backward, but I cannot perceive him. On the left hand, which was north, where he doth work, but I cannot behold him. He hideth himself on the right hand, the south, that I cannot see him." But notice, "but he knoweth the way that I take. And when he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold." This is one of the remarkable statements in the book of Job. Job is being sifted through this entire process. He's been put in a place, it's easy for us to read, that I have never been, that most of us have never been. Children being stripped away in a day, all 10 kids, his health, his best friends, his possessions, his home, everything gone. And Job had been a righteous man, perfect. God said that to me. And Job doesn't know the transaction between God and Satan, what's going on in the background, behind the stage. And he struggles tremendously. And yet along the way, all of a sudden, his faith rises up and he makes this statement. And here somehow he has a sense that God knows. I can't find him, but he knows where I am. I can't see him right now. I see his hand. But he does see me. He knows the way that I take. And when I am tried, he has a sense that there's something in his life that God has deemed worth trying. "I shall come forth as gold." In other words, to put metal, to put anything in the crucible, to try it, to refine it, you have to see something worth trying in the first place. And somehow in this, Job is groping, but his faith is evolving. And he says, "When he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. My foot hath held his steps." Now, and listen to these verses. This is without an Old Testament, without a New Testament. You know, how many of us as Christians, with all kinds of the benefit of God's Word and public meeting places and being filled with the Spirit and knowing, you know, the revelation of the Word of Christ as our Savior, can say these things? He says, "My foot hath held his steps. His way have I kept, and not declined," regardless of what his friends are saying. "Neither have I gone back from the commandment of his lips." And he doesn't tell us how he knows anything about a commandment from the Lord's lip. It seems this is before the Old Testament was written. "Neither have I gone back from the commandment of his lips. I have esteemed the words of his mouth more than my necessary food." I've esteemed the word of God more important than my physical nourishment. "But he is in one mind, and who can turn him?" The idea is he's immutable. He doesn't change. He's unchangeable. "He is in one mind. And who can turn him? And what his soul desireth, even that he doeth. Now Job says, even though I've kept his path, even though I have not declined, even though I've considered his word more than my necessary food, none of these things has been to change God. That's not why I've done these things, because he doesn't change. He's of one mind. No one can turn him. What his soul desires, even that he doeth, for he performeth the thing, notice, that is appointed for me. Job acknowledging the sovereignty of God. That's difficult to do in a painful situation. He performeth the thing that is appointed for me, and many such things are with him. The idea is many such things are still in store for my life with God. He's performing the things now that he's appointed. God isn't taken by surprise in all this. That's why I would want to hear from him and know what he's doing. This isn't, you know, taking him. He's not shocked at my misfortune. He's performing the thing he's appointed for me, and many such things are with him. Therefore am I troubled at his presence. Now, it's one of the troubling things of the sovereignty of God. You know, I'm glad that he's sovereign when it comes to my salvation. I'm glad that he's sovereign when he's the God that calls things that are not as though they were, because that's how he can look at me and say, Job Foshah is justified, sanctified, glorified. I'm glad that he's sovereign, that at a shout and the voice of the archangel and the trumpet of God, he's going to lift me up off this old ball of dirt into his presence forever. I'm glad that he's not ashamed to be called my God and to call me his son. I'm thankful for so many parts of his sovereignty, that he is sovereign. No one will argue him from those positions. But there is another part of his sovereignty that fuels the fear of God in my life. That he has the right to my life. It's not mine, it's his. My children, they're on loan. They're not mine, they're his. My wife, he's sovereign. And from where Job is at this point in time, he says, you know, there's still stuff that's in store for me, and the way things are going right now, that troubles me a little bit. Therefore am I troubled at his presence. When I consider, I am afraid of him, thinking there's more of this in store. For God maketh my heart soft. Job, I'd have said a lot worse than that, the situation you're in. He makes my heart soft, and the Almighty troubleth me. Because, listen to what he says, I was not cut off before the darkness, neither hath he covered the darkness from my face. He's saying God has neither slain me nor protected me. He hasn't done either. I wish he'd have done one or the other. He hasn't cut me off before the darkness. I mean, you know, before these terrible days have come, I wish he'd have just cut me off. He didn't do that. On the other hand, neither has he covered the darkness from my face. He's let me look and step right into this mess. So he hasn't protected me and he hasn't slain me. And in light of that, I'm troubled. Why, seeing times are not hidden from the Almighty, do they that know him not see his days? Now he's going to give another answer to Eliphaz about the fact that the wicked do seem to prosper in this world, but he's going to describe their ultimate end. And again, we're not that long after the flood. So as we hear from Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, that the righteous are spared and the wicked suffer, remember, a large part of their theology may be in light of the fact that God judged the whole world because of his wickedness. And remember that what they're saying is true ultimately in eternity. In eternity, the wicked will pay their dues. It will catch up with them. They get away with nothing, though it appears that way in our earthly existence. And the righteous ultimately are rewarded, though they may have difficulty in this present life. In ultimate terms, what they're saying is true. So there is some truth. They know some stuff, but they're not helping Job, and what they say is not applicable to his situation. Job says, why seeing times are not hidden from the Almighty, God knows everybody's life, do they that know him not see his days? Why does he let them then live on? The wicked seem to go on and are not judged. Some remove the landmarks. They violently take away flocks and feed thereon. Now the Deuteronomy 19, Deuteronomy 27, Hosea, twice in Proverbs 22 and 23, there is the admonition not to remove the ancient landmarks. And again, those were the boundaries of your property. You didn't have a stone wall or a barbed wire fence. You piled up a pile of stones that marked the end of your inheritance and the beginning of your neighbor's. But there is something about that. There was a curse pronounced on anybody that removed those, because you remember Jacob on his deathbed had prophesied about the land being divided to the tribes, and hundreds of years, over 400 years later, When the lot is cast with Joshua, those parcels, that inheritance, fall out in harmony with what Jacob had prophesied 400 years before that. And Israel understood their inheritance was a divine appointment. They had been set free from Egypt. God had brought them into the land, as he had said, and he had apportioned the land and given it to the tribes according to his foreknowledge. So those inheritances they had by their families, the land was not theirs. God said, you're leasing it from me. I own the land. And they understood that the landmarks were divine boundaries that God had established. So yes, there was the practical side of it, but it was more than that. And they understood many times in Scripture, which wasn't written at this point, there would be the admonition not to remove the ancient landmarks. Now certainly, that also speaks of boundaries in our society that have been broken down when we look at the moral condition of our nation. Those things that at one time were considered absolutes are gone. They've been removed. Not just moved, but sometimes completely removed. And we wonder, again, why those things moving incrementally as the years go on until we're desensitized and we, as a nation, have no longer these ancient landmarks marking divine boundaries. They violently take away flocks and feed thereof as they move and take advantage, the wicked. They drive away the ass of the fatherless. They would take the beast of burden from the orphan, which without a dad, that was their main source of income. They take the widow's ox for a pledge. The widow who's in debt because she has no husband and her only means of plowing the soil would be her ox. They take that away because she's in debt. They turn the needy out of the way. The poor of the earth hide themselves together. A picture of the way the poor and the unfortunate are so often trapped in their situation. There are many today in this nation that feel bound to their poverty, feel they can't find a way out of it. And this talks about the way the wicked of the earth that are prosperous get away with murder. They call the shots, they run things, and they set up a system where people can't escape their social class sometimes. And what an interesting picture of the injustice of all that we have here. Behold, as wild asses, speaking of the wicked, verse 5, in the desert go they forth to their work, rising betimes for a prey. They get up early looking for their prey. The wilderness yieldeth food for them and for their children, like the wild donkeys that seem to survive in the desert without a problem. They reap every one his grain in the field. They gather the vintage of the wicked, and the grapes of the wrath of God will one day be trampled out. They're gathering the vintage of the wicked. They, the wicked, cause the naked to lodge without clothing. They have no covering in the cold. And as the law would be written, it would be forbidden to take for a pledge from someone poor their robe. You could take it during the day. It had to be given back at night because oftentimes that was the only covering they had. This cold-heartedness here. They are wet, the poor, with the showers of the mountains. They embrace the rock for want of shelter, living in caves. They, the wicked, pluck the fatherless from the breast and take a pledge of the poor. They take children away from a widow or from a mother that's in debt and make that child a servant to pay the debt of that parent. They cause him to go naked without clothing. They take away the sheaf from the hungry, those that the stranger and the widow allowed to gather the corners of the field. They take the sheaf away from the hungry, which make oil within their walls. They don't have olive presses. They do what they can within their own homes. They tread their wine presses. The idea is in their own home is the only place they have to gather the needs of life. And they suffer thirst. Men groan from out of the city. Now he's moving to the city, and he doesn't have to tell us about that. We live in the city of brotherly shove, so we know all about this. Men groan from out of the city. United States, on average, 60 murders a day in this nation, across the nation. Gang slayings, domestic violence, child abuse, murder, bank robbery. On an average of 60 murders a day in America. That comes out to 22,000 murders a year. Try to imagine that. If we would lose 22,000 of our military in an operation in Afghanistan, what that would mean. We lost 3,000 in the trade towers. 22,000 a year. The ancient landmarks removed. Violence. You know, again, when I was a kid, and we lived over on Rising Sun Avenue, and my grandparents, my grandfather lived in the house with us, my grandmother and my grandfather, my mom's mom and dad lived up the street. We lived in row homes, and the whole neighborhood knew each other, and my parents basically told the neighborhood, if he even looks suspicious, feel free to beat him. You know, they sent around flyers with my picture. This is our son. You can spank him. We do it all the time. Feel free. Some of you remember those days. And I'll tell you this. If a neighbor had to smack me, I got beat when I got home because a neighbor had to smack me. I don't want to go home. I get the second beating when I went home. We couldn't do that today, could we? Imagine that if your neighbor beat your kids today. The world has changed, hasn't it? My mom used to leave me out front in the stroller and work all day out on the front porch. But it was not really a porch. It was just out in front of the room. Because she said, you know, the fresh air was good for me, you know. My dad, when he was a kid, he had rheumatic fever, so they sent him out on the farm to work for 2 years. Figure that would straighten him out. You know, it was a different generation, you know. And would work in the house for 4 or 5 hours and leave me out there. You couldn't do that today. Dave Sheinfeld was telling me that his mom used to go shopping at the food market and just park him outside and take the cart and go in and do food shopping and leave him outside. Hoping maybe that it's a different world. It is so sad. It's a different world. Men groan from out of the city, and the soul of the wounded crieth out. Yet God layeth not folly to them. Now that is wrong. God is keeping record very accurately. And in eternity, the tale will be told. They are of those that rebel against the light. They know not the ways thereof, nor abide in the paths thereof. Now remember, this is before the scripture is written. This isn't just talking about physical light. He's going to talk a little bit about that. But it doesn't just say that they sin against light. They actually rebel against the light. There are those who will not yield to conviction. And Romans 1 tells us that there's enough of God revealed in creation that man is without excuse. The murderer, rising with the light, killeth the poor and needy, and in the night is a thief. So he murders during the day, he's a thief at night. The eye also of the adulterer, sexual sin, waiteth for the twilight, saying, no eye shall see me. He disguises his face. And again, that's an illusion. Because David in his repentance would say, against thee and thee only have I sinned and done this great evil in thy sight, O Lord. And Hebrews telling us, all things are open and naked before the one with whom we have to do. Sexual sin is open before the eyes of God. And when it's between believers, it's incest with a brother or a sister. It is incest in God's family. In the dark, verse 16, they dig through houses. They had mud brick houses then, so they could dig through the walls when nobody was home, which they had marked for themselves in the daytime. They know not the light. For the morning is to them even as the shadow of death. If one know them, they are in terrors. If somebody recognizes them, of the shadow of, they're paranoid during the day. They like to, sin loves the darkness. Jesus told us that. They like to go out and sin at night when they won't be recognized. And in the daytime, they're paranoid. And again, the Lord sees all of that. Charles Spurgeon said that the reason a sinner can't find Christ is the same thing that a bank, same reason a bank robber can't find a policeman. Verse 18. You can think about that. That's just a free information in the midst of Job here. The wicked now, the tally will be told. He is swift as waters, the raging of a stream. Their portion is cursed in the earth. He beholdeth not the way of the vineyards. Not to do an honest day's, earn an honest day's wage, not part of their mindset. Drought and the heat consume the snow waters. When the snow melting in the water, many times their streams around Mount Hermon in the spring, and they run very cold, and they run much more aggressively in the spring because the snow is melting. Drought and heat consume the snow waters, so doth the grave those which have sinned. The womb shall forget them, their mother, the one that bare them. And, of course, this is Hebrew poetry, so you have to take that in stride as he says, the worm shall feed sweetly on him. Nice worms. The worm shall feed sweetly on him. He shall be no more remembered, and wickedness shall be broken as a tree. He evil entreated the barren that beareth not, mocking the barren woman, and that was considered a curse in that day, and doeth not good to the widow. And all through the scripture, God takes up for the widow and the orphan. He draweth also the mighty with his power of wickedness. He entices the powerful to be in league with him. He, the mighty, riseth up, and no man is sure of life. He thinks he's established, but it's a false security, Job says, in league with the wicked. Though it be given him to be in safety, though God allows this to go on for a time, whereon he resteth, yet his, God's, eyes are upon their ways. God's eyes are upon the ways of the wicked, though it seems like they're prospering right now. Don't be deceived. Don't be envious, Psalm 73. They are exalted for a little while, but are gone and brought low. They are taken out of the way as all others, and cut off like the tops of the grain, the ears of grain. Remember Jesus said, you know, even in regards to the last day, not to try to tear out the tares, lest you uproot the wheat also. Let them both grow to harvest, and the angels will be sent in to gather the wheat into the granary, and to gather the tares into bundles and burn them. They shall be cut off as the tops of the ears of grain. And if it be not so, now who will make me a liar and make my speech worth nothing? Job now answering Eliphaz and his friends, who were saying, oh, wicked people suffer and righteous people prosper. Therefore, Job, you must be wicked because of what's going on in your life. Job says, no way. Ultimately, I know God's going to deal with them. But look what's going on in the world. Look what's going on in the cities. Look at the immorality. Look at the murder. Look at the theft. Look at the things that are taking place. Look at the poor that are being taken advantage of. Look at the world and how it's filled with injustice. How often does that aggravate many of us? How often do people get fed up with politics? You know, when you look at the percentage of Americans that are voting, it's a shame. But so many of them think, what's the use? What's the point? They all say the same thing and they all do the same thing. Nothing. Why should I bother? That's a shame. Because we have a great privilege and honor, the cost of others' blood, to go to that ballot box and to vote. But there are many people that are just throwing up their hands saying, what's the point? Because wickedness does have its way. We're watching it in so many arenas. But Job says, but ultimately, I know what you're saying is true, Eliphaz, ultimately, their debt will be paid. And if I'm not right now, who's going to make me a liar? Who's going to tell me my speech isn't worthy? You prove that what I'm saying is wrong. Then answered Bildad. And this is the final time that we have to endure Bildad. This is the third time that he speaks, and wonderfully, he only speaks for 6 verses. Then answered Bildad, the Shuhite, and said, dominion and fear are with him, with the Lord. And he's kind of agreeing to a degree what Job said. He maketh peace in his high places. Now, we're not sure. We're going to head into some interesting verses here. Remember, this is probably the patriarchal age. The tales and the records of the flood and why judgment came, what was going on before the flood, are very fresh in the minds of many. We can tell by the speech. And he says, God is the one, his dominion and his fear are with him. He made peace in his high places. Now, he cast Satan out of heaven. There was a rebellion. Revelation chapter 12 kind of gives us this cryptic picture of this whole process, and that it seems that a third of the stars were cast out of heaven with Satan. And is that what he's making reference to? We're not sure. He maketh peace in his high places. He settled things there. Is there any number of his armies? And upon whom doth not his light arise? Are there any numbers to his armies? We know that Enoch saw the Lord coming with 10,000s of his saints. Revelation chapter 5, verse 11, I believe, says the angels that were around the throne of God were 10,000 times 10,000, then times thousands and times thousands. Hundreds and hundreds of millions. It's just numbers beyond recognition. How great are his armies? Interesting question. You remember in 2 Kings chapter 19, that one angel came into the camp of the Assyrians one night and slew 185,000 Assyrians in one night. One angel. Think of what Jesus knew when he said to Peter, when he cut off Malchus's ear. Remember, Jesus picked it up, stuck it back on, and said, Peter, put your sword back in its sheath. Don't you know that I could call 12 legions of angels right now if I wanted to? 12 legions is 72,000 angels. Now, what can 72,000 angels do if one angel can kill 185,000 in one night? Just to get an idea, you take 185,000, you multiply it by 72,000, and you get 13,320,000,000. That's in one night. That's more than the population of the planet. How great are his armies? And that's 72,000. That's not 10,000 times 10,000 times thousands of thousands. How great are his armies? What did these ancient men know? How then can man be justified with God, this great, incredible, powerful God? He's challenging Job. How can you be justified? Or how can he be clean that is born of a woman? Behold, even to the moon, and it shineth not. Yea, the stars are not pure in his sight. The heavens not clean. How much less man, that is, King James, a worm, a maggot. We go to a lot of work to avoid that kind of low self-esteem picture of ourselves, and we've written maggot books about. How much less man, that is a maggot, and the Son of Man, which is a worm. Job infested with worms at this point in time. But Job answered. Now, I'm thankful that he cut off Bildad. I mean, I was digging Bildad a little bit there in those verses, and there's more interesting stuff there than in some of his discourses, but I'm glad Job cut him off before he started to bore me again. But Job answered, and this is Job's longest answer now, and I believe it goes to chapter 32, and we don't hear any more from Zophar, and I hope you don't mind that. Seems like he only got two shots at Job and the rest got three, but we do hear from Elihu now, who's going to be a new guy once we get to chapter 32. Job answered and said, "How hast thou helped him that is without power?" Thanks, Bild. You know, how have you helped him that is without power? How savest thou the arm that hath no strength? How hast thou counseled him that hath no wisdom? And how hast thou plentifully declared the thing as it is? You think you're smart, don't you? To whom hast thou uttered words? And whose spirit came from you? Because you're also a maggot. That's the idea. He's, you know, God sent for this. What spirit came from you, Bildad? Now he enters into some other interesting things here. Dead things are formed from under the waters. Thanks, Job. And the inhabitants thereof. Dead things are formed from under the waters. There's an interesting play with the Hebrew words. Rapha, Jehovah Rapha, is the Lord that heals, but that Rapha can also mean death, depending on the punctuation. Rephaim can be a word that's sometimes looked at as dead, but the ancients knew the Rephaim were of the giants, of the Nephilim. So it's interesting to look back on some of these things. The Rephaim, and that's the word in the Hebrew here, dead things, Rephaim, probably akin to the Nephilim. This is Bullinger in his word study from the Hebrew. The Nephilim were the awful progeny of the fallen angels. These had all been destroyed by the flood. Maybe that's why Job's saying they're under the waters. But there is a second eruption also after that, and the progeny seems to have been called Rephaim, the giants. These settled in Canaan, had to be destroyed. Hence Israel had to exterminate them. Moses destroyed some. David destroyed some. There ended up to be the Rephaim, the Emim, the Zamzumans, the Emims, the Anakins. It was a bunch of them. The Septuagint, which is a translation from the Hebrew into Greek, 285 years before Christ, without the bias of modern logic. They weren't bound by anything but making a translation. Translate this verse, "Shall giants be born from under the water, and the inhabitants thereof?" The Targum, again, a translation of the Aramaic, translates this verse, "Is it possible that the mighty who are decayed will recover when they are below the waters and in their camps?" So we're not sure what in the world Job is speaking of, and nobody agrees on it, but he has a bead on something that was evidently more taken for granted in his own day, talking about the judgment of the wicked. Maybe that's how this plays in there. Dead things are formed under the waters, the inhabitants thereof. Hell is naked before him, and destruction hath no covering. He stretched out the north over the empty place, and hangeth the earth upon nothing. Now again, we're over 2,000 years before Christ. He stretches out the empty place. He stretches out the north over the empty place. Is he talking about when God, you know, in the beginning God created, bara, ex nihilo, created something from nothing. The earth was without form and void. Unformed and Unfilled by Weston Fields is a great book to read on that verse if you get hung up there right in the second verse of the Bible. And it says that the Spirit was brooding upon the face of the waters. It seems a picture of God bringing together. He created something from nothing. Here is it seems to be saying that He stretched out the north over the empty place, that he set gravitational field and he set the point of the compass where the earth ends up having its axis, that he set the north right in the middle of the empty expanses of space, that he set a direction. He set a compass point. He set the gravitational field which would create the axis of the earth. And then he hung the earth upon nothing. Now that's remarkable, because in the 1300s, again, they had, you know, the Greeks had Hercules holding up the earth. I don't know what he was standing on. They didn't bother to think that far. Now that's like the people who say, you know, we weren't created, we were planted here by aliens. It doesn't tell us where they came from, you know. This had to start, the same problem just goes back a little further. And then in the 13th century, Europe had the earth on the back of an elephant. And then the elephant standing on the back of a huge tortoise. Somebody must have said, well, what's the elephant standing on? That's dummy standing on a tortoise. Oh, not, well, what's the tortoise standing on? Job, over 2,000 years before Christ, said he stretched out the magnetic fields in the empty place in the north, and then he suspended the earth on nothing. That's remarkable. He bindeth up the waters in the clouds, and the cloud is not rent under them. We, just this century, learn about the proper updrafts that move the heavy clouds up so that they don't break open and that it rains in the right places at the right times. It says, he bindeth up the water in the clouds, and they're not torn. They're not torn under them. He holdeth back the face of his throne, and spreadeth his cloud upon it. No doubt the glory cloud. He's established his throne in another dimension, right in our midst. Jesus walking in the midst of the church. But he hides the face of it. He hath compassed the waters with bounds until the day and the night come to an end. Now, it seems to be talking about the point where in the rotation of the earth, where scientists today decide is the dividing line between one day and the next, between night and day. He sets the sea in their bounds. puts a compass upon them, draws them into a circle until day and night come to an end, in speaking of the rotation of the earth. The pillars of heaven tremble and are astonished at his reproof. He divideth the sea with his power, and by his understanding he smiteth through the proud. Now this seems to be before the Red Sea. So he divideth the sea. Is he dividing the firmament above the heavens from the firmament below the heavens? Is he dividing the land from the sea? Divideth the sea with his power, and by his understanding he smiteth through the proud. By his spirit he hath garnished the heavens, and his hand hath formed the crooked serpent, which seems to be one of the constellations. By his spirit he's garnished. You know, we send Hubble out there. It didn't work, then we had to fix it. But we send Hubble out there. And I don't know about you, you get to see some of the color photos of... Some of it is just astounding. It's staggering. It's so beautiful. And billions of light years. And we wonder, you know, at the purpose of all of that. When we watch the days of creation, it seems the universe is geocentric. That God's plan was centered around Earth. It wasn't until the fourth, fifth day that he set the stars and the moon to mark off seasons and times and put them in their places. It seems the center of it all is Jerusalem, and the center of all that is Golgotha, and the center of the plan of the ages is his Son crucified and risen. Without that, no purpose in letting anything roll out, because even the heavens themselves are going to be rolled up like a scroll one day. So here it just says he garnished like emerald. Bam! You know, it just, you know, he finished everything and then he garnished the heavens with, you know, parsley, you know, stars and galaxies, and he garnished the heavens. And you have to understand what a staggering thing, you know, you think about it, all of that created in motion. Maybe you're not a creationist. Well, you have more problems than I do. But for those of us that are creationists, just think of what we're saying. You know, the days the trees were created, did they already have rings in them? There had to be coral reefs already in place that didn't take 5,000 years to form for the ecosystem to work properly. There had to be salmon returning to streams that they were never born in their migratory patterns. And there had to be, if he garnished the heavens with the stars, and some of them are 20 billion light years away, or a million light years away, there had to be a shaft of light between that star and the earth the day it was created. Because if there wasn't, it still wouldn't be here. And there wouldn't be any stars in the heavens. If we had to wait 20 billion light years for it to get here, or a million light years for it to get here, it still wouldn't be here. He garnished the heavens. That's remarkable. Lo, verse 14, these are parts of his ways. There's just a smattering of some God stuff. But how little a portion is heard of him. We don't even know the half of it. But the thunder of his power, who can understand? Moreover, Job continued his parable and said, as God liveth, who hath taken away my judgment, and the Almighty who hath vexed my soul? All the while my breath is in me, and the Spirit of God is in my nostrils, my lips shall not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. Aware that evidently God breathed the breath of life into Adam's nostrils, as all the while that my breath is in me and the Spirit of God, the breath of God in my nostrils, my lips shall not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. Well, that's remarkable, because as Spirit-filled Christians, I'm sure we say things we shouldn't say under the right amount of pressure. God forbid, verse 5, that I should justify you, speaking to his three friends who are trying to force this theology on him. God forbid that I should justify you. I'm not going to admit to doing something that I haven't done just to make your theology seem right. Till I die, I will not remove mine integrity from me. I'm going to maintain my argument. My righteousness I hold fast and will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me so long as I live. I'm not condemned, guys. You may be trying to condemn me, but I'm not condemned. I haven't sinned before the Lord. No personal condemnation. Let mine enemy be as the wicked, and he that riseth up against me as the unrighteous. You want to pick on somebody? Do it to my enemy. For what is the hope of the hypocrite, though he hath gained, when God taketh away his soul? Interesting verse. What is the hope of the hypocrite when he has gained? In the day that God takes away his soul. Will God hear his cry when trouble cometh upon him? Will he delight himself in the Almighty? Will he always call upon God? No, just in the day that he's scared to death. I will teach you by the hand of God, that is that which is with the Almighty will I not conceal. Behold, all ye yourselves have seen it. Why then are ye thus altogether vain? Why do I have to listen to this empty nonsense? This is the portion of a wicked man with God, and the heritage of oppressors which they shall receive of the Almighty. Job's agreeing that ultimately the wicked are judged. If his children be multiplied, it is for the sword, and his offspring shall not be satisfied with bread. Those that remain of him shall be buried in death, and his widows shall not weep. Though he heap up silver as the dust, and prepare raiment as clay, as dirt, as, you know, as much silver as the dust on the floor, and as many different changes of clothing as the dirt, he may prepare it, but the just shall put it on, and the innocent shall divide the silver. He buildeth his house as a moth, and as a booth that the keeper maketh. He builds his house like a moth making a cocoon that ends up to be nothing. It dissolves. The rich man shall lie down, but he shall not be gathered. Speaking of the wicked rich. He openeth his eyes, and he is not. Terrors take hold on him as waters. A tempest stealeth him away in the night. The east wind carrieth him away, and he departeth. And as a storm hurleth him out of his place. Man, that sounds like a bad night. For God shall cast upon him and not spare. He would fain flee out of his hand. That's the day would come when the wicked would try, who have denied God all through their entire lives, will try to escape out of his hand. You know, Jonathan Edwards, sinners in the hand of an angry God, then at that point it's too late. Men shall clap their hands at him and shall hiss him out of his place. Ultimately, the wicked, Job says, do suffer. He agrees with that part of what they have to say. And eternity certainly is the thing that must be kept before us as we look at these things. I don't know. We could take a run at that chapter. Sure. Surely. That's the first word. Okay. Surely there is a vein for the silver and a place where gold is mined. Iron is taken out of the earth and brass is molten out of stone. He setteth an end. Now, this is someone who's mining. There's a vein they follow where they mine silver and gold. They even take iron out of the earth for practical things. The miner, the one who's down there digging his tunnels, he setteth an end to darkness. He makes a shaft for light to come down and searches out all perfection, looking for gems and gold, the stones of darkness that are hidden in the earth, as he's trying to find, and the shadow of death. the flood breaketh out from the inhabitant. You know, mining often hitting an underground stream and it begins to flood the mine, the shaft. The flood breaketh out from the inhabitant, even the waters forgotten of the foot. People on the surface have no idea what's going on. They are dried up as far as people are concerned, maybe talking about the large underground aqua system that was broken up during the flood. They are gone away from men. As for the earth, out of it cometh bread, and the grain, the basic sustenance that we need in life is right on the surface. We don't have to dig down inside the mountains to survive. But under it, it is turned up as it were fire, volcanic activity and so forth. The stones of it are the place of sapphires, and it hath dust of gold. There is a path which no fowl knoweth, which the vulture's eye hath not seen, the lion's whelps have not trodden it, for the fierce lion passed by it. He putteth forth his hand, the miner, upon the rock. He overturneth the mountains by the roots. He cutteth out rivers among the rocks. He makes a channel for the excess water to run out. His eye seeth every precious thing. He bindeth the floods from overflowing, and the thing that is hidden he brings forth out into the light. Man knows no end to his greed. Job says, look, you know, consider this. You know, look what man will do to get his hand on some diamonds, on some rubies. Consider man putting life and limb into jeopardy, digging into the earth. And this is Job's day. This is ages and ages ago, you know. But the Bronze Age, born out of this period, where man understood how to take ore, retrieve ore from the ground. But Job says, you know, look what people will jeopardize life and limb for wealth. You know, right on the surface of the earth is everything we need to live, to be sustained. But man is not content with that. Paul says in Timothy's letter, we should be content if we have food and raiment and a roof over our heads. Godliness with contentment is great gain. We brought nothing into the world. We're not going to take anything out. But Job says, look at man, look at the way they burrow into the earth. Look at the way they're, you know, trying to get their hands on greater riches and not just satisfied with sustenance. Look at what man, look at the extremes that man will go to. And, you know, even there's a part of this that the eagle, the greatest, you know, ability to see that we understand, able to read a newspaper a block away. That's the resolution in an eagle's eye. A full city block away could read the small print in a newspaper. Don't you wish you could do that? I just wish I could read one this far away without my glasses. Not seen by that eye. And the most contentious of beasts, the fiercest competitors, the lions, know nothing of all of this. But man, different nature. Different longing, different insatiable, wanting more, more. Look what man will do to get wealth. But where shall wisdom be found? Where is the place of understanding? Man knoweth not the price thereof, neither is it found in the land of the living. You know, Job saying, hey, you know, in my position, all my children dead, my home removed, my friends have turned their backs on me, everything in my life is dissolved. I had great wealth, it's all gone. Everything that I thought was important, the only thing now that I long for is wisdom and understanding. If I could only understand what God is doing, I walk with God, I love God, I was righteous before God. I'm, you know, God forbid I should justify any of you guys with your strange theology. I love the Lord and I walk before Him. And man doesn't understand the value of wisdom, the price thereof, the necessity to hear God speaking to us when life is falling apart, when we're facing our mortality. Man knoweth not the price thereof, neither is it found in the land of the living. The depth, hell, says, it is not in me. That's not where you're going to find wisdom. The sea saith, it is not in me. You can travel all over the world on the high seas. It's not in me. It cannot be gotten for gold, neither shall silver be weighed for the price thereof. It cannot be valued with the gold of Ophir, with the precious onyx and sapphire. The gold and the crystal cannot equal it. And the exchange of it shall not be for jewelry, for vessels of gold. No mention shall be made of coral or of pearls, For the price of wisdom is above rubies. The topaz of Ethiopia shall not equal it, neither shall it be valued with pure gold. There is nothing in this world to be compared with the value of wisdom and understanding, particularly in the most difficult circumstances of life. And that's where Job is at this point. Whence then cometh wisdom? Well, then where is it from? If men are ignorant of it and they give their lives to so many vain things, if there's nothing on earth to trade for it, purchase it with, then where does it come from? How is it attained? Whence cometh wisdom? Where is the place of understanding? Seeing it is hid from the eyes of all the living and kept close from the fowls of the air. Destruction and death say, we have heard the fame thereof with our ears. God understandeth the way thereof, and he knows the place thereof. For he looketh to the ends of the earth, and he seeth under the whole heaven, to make the weight for the winds. And he weighed the waters by measure. When he made a decree for the rain, and the way for the lightning of thunder, then did he see it, and declare it, and prepared it, yea, and searched it out. And unto man he said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to depart from evil, that is understanding. Job says this, where then is wisdom attained? How is it taken hold of? It's a hidden thing. But God understands the way thereof. And God's resource of wisdom and understanding is without measure, Job says. And with the wisdom and the understanding he had, he set up a place for the living. He set up a hydro system that sustains life. He measured the waters and the rain and made the way for lightning. And he set up a system that maintains an atmosphere. And he set up a place for us to exist, for us to live out our days. And in the middle of that, God speaks and says, the fear of the Lord, that's wisdom for you. And to turn away from evil, that's understanding. God, who has all wisdom and understanding, all power, sets up an environment for us, for his children, for our well-being, that we might live. And is not distant or unattached, but speaks into it and says to his own, the fear of the Lord, for you, that's wisdom. Fear of the Lord, not reverential awe, fear. Fear. Again, when the trade towers came down, we saw the fear of God. Church was jammed because people thought, is it going to happen here? Is it going to happen in Philly? Is it going to happen to me? Is it going to happen in my life? Every prodigal came back. People came back just to see if the rapture happened, wondered if they were going to find the church locked and us gone when they got here. People we hadn't seen since the Persian Gulf crisis came back to church. Fear of God. Not an unhealthy thing, a healthy thing. Not a thing that paralyzes, a thing that energizes. The fear of God.